Part 3. Dark State. History repeats itself, first as tragedy, then as farce. Karl Marx. Extraction. The Commonwealth. Timeline 3. May 2020. Miriam and Erasmus spent a night in the bunker waiting for the bombs to fall, drinking bad coffee, and grinding through a crisis agenda inconclusively. Elsewhere, hundreds of pilots spent the night keyed up and sleepless in the cockpits of their nuclear-armed interceptors, wondering if this time the French were finally coming. And they were not alone, for the Commonwealth War Command responded to the uncertain threat in accordance with the age-old syllogism of the uncertain. Something must be done. This is something, therefore this must be done. Petard carriers, bombers, and their escort tankers scrambled, then flew out to orbit their holdback points in the howling darkness above the Arctic Ocean. They flew armed and ready for the deadly one-way dash to the enemy capitals, to London, Paris, Cairo, Beijing, Bombay, and the heart of the enemy empire itself, Royal St. Petersburg. Across the flat prairies of Lakota Land, flight crews descended into their silos and pumped liquid fuel aboard their bulbous first-generation ICBMs. In the oceans, submarine captains received their low-frequency alert codes and brought their nuclear-powered vessels to periscope depth while the missile teams readied their birds. But it was an exercise in impotence. None of the bombers or ICBMs or SLBMs carried the world walkers, who were a necessity if they were to engage the real threat. By dawn of the day after this death watch, it became clear that the sum of all fears had not come to pass. The high-altitude drone was not the harbinger of Armageddon. Across the new American Commonwealth's three continents and scattered territories, the unsleeping air defense forces saw nothing else unusual. After 12 hours of intense concentration, for, as Dr. Johnson had so memorably observed, nothing concentrates the mind like the knowledge that one is to be hanged, the Commonwealth War Command began to draw down their forces, unit by unit, backing slowly away from the brink of a nuclear war with the only adversary they knew how to fight. All except for Juggernaut, of course. But the Juggernaut superweapon was behind schedule and over budget. It might never be ready. And even if it was viable, it was anyone's guess whether it would work. After all, the Commonwealth war planners knew that bombers and ICBMs and ballistic missile submarines worked. They'd supped at the fount of dark wisdom supplied by the Ministry of Intertemporal Technological Intelligence. They'd studied the Cuban Missile Crisis, the emergency at the end of the Yom Kippur War, and the ghastly intersection of Operation Ryan and Able Archer 83 that had brought the Soviet Union and the United States to the edge of nuclear annihilation in the mid-1980s. They'd majored in Cold War studies. Hiroshima and Nagasaki and New Delhi and Islamabad were on the syllabus of the Staff College at Rochester. But nobody in any timeline they knew of had ever built anything quite like Juggernaut, much less developed doctrine for using it. New London, Timeline 3, June 2020. "How long has he got?" Miriam asked bluntly. Dr. Porter, the oncology consultant, looked tired. He'd probably answered the question 16 times before breakfast already.
"It's anyone's guess," he said unhelpfully. "The Lord will know his own."
Miriam glanced sidelong at her husband. Erasmus appeared to be paying more attention to the writing pad on his lap than to her interrogation of the doctor. It was an old habit of his. "I know cachexia when I see it," she said. "I also know acute spinal degeneration secondary to metastatic tumors, and peripheral neuropathy. Dr. Porter's eyes widened.
"I see ma'am is up to date on the new foreign literature," he said.
"Ma'am is actually very out of date indeed," but Miriam decided not to mention her uncompleted pre-med to him. She merely smiled tensely. "What's his prognosis? Days or weeks?"
"Ah, well."
Porter looked faintly relieved.
"Well, the first man may not be as close to death's door as you believe. You met him at his worst last week. He's currently responding well to a combination treatment. Fluorouracil and cisplatin, and radiation as well. I will not mince words with you. His prognosis is terminal. But while one can never rule out sudden setbacks, he might hang on for as long as 6 months."
Fluorouracil and cisplatin were 1970s chemotherapy drugs, but the Commonwealth was nowhere near ready to begin production of monoclonal antibody and epigenetic interference therapies. And Adam himself had refused point-blank to consider a discreet trip to a private Brazilian clinic in Timeline 2.
"It is my duty to stand by my people, and if necessary, to suffer as they do,"
he'd pointed out to Erasmus when they'd come to visit his bedside the day before.
"If there's an easy escape for the likes of us, when will we ever develop the indigenous technology?"
He'd glanced at Miriam, eyelids fluttering.
"To rescue our people."
16 years ago, Sir Adam had swallowed her two-phase proposal completely. So completely he was willing to die by it. She'd lobbied to establish a ministry to use world walkers to import knowledge and ideas and spread the spoils via educational establishments. But it was essential that they use these tools only to develop native infrastructure, from schools and universities to research establishments and factories. The Commonwealth must stand on its own, rather than becoming addicted to a steady drip of illicit imports from another timeline, as the Grunmarkt had. It had seemed like a really good idea at the time, she thought, not without bitterness, until the saintly father of the nation decided they were words to live and die by.
Setbacks.
Miriam tried not to scowl, not entirely successfully.
Well, doctor,
while I appreciate your doing everything within your capabilities to help keep the first man going, I was, shall we say, taken aback. As you might understand, the state of his health ultimately affects my commission. And my husband's... It still felt strange calling him that, even after 14 years. Duties, too, as Commissioner of Propaganda. We both have necessary and sufficient reason to be added to the distribution list for his daily updates. Dr. Porter looked unhappy.
If the first man consents, of course. Otherwise, power of attorney in respect of his physiodynamic needs rests with the secretary to the inner party.
Oh, hell. Miriam failed to suppress a twitch this time. Nor did she miss the tension that suddenly appeared in the set of Erasmus's shoulders. Then I will take this up with the secretariat, she assured Dr. Porter. Standing, she turned to her husband. I think we've heard enough, dear. Erasmus rose and offered her his arm. Thank you, doctor. Dr. Porter, too, rose and bowed and ushered them out of his office with old-school formality.
Well, fuck,
Miriam whispered as they passed through the waiting room, which was crowded with no small number of deputy commissioners, secretaries, and a handful of nursing orderlies and junior doctors. The Manhattan Palace was sprouting medical facilities, as if engaged in a bizarre bid to rival the teaching hospitals of New London.
We'll have to soft soap Adrian, she confided in Erasmus.
Her husband's face was a closed book.
I trust our friend the secretary as far as I can throw him, he hissed.
Can't be helped. Have to confront him sooner or later. Better now than in cabinet when Sir Adam's too sick to keep up the pretense anymore. Outside the Palace Medical Center, they picked up their respective retinues of clerks and administrative assistants
and proceeded by common consent toward what had once, before the revolution, been the Empress's chambers. They walked together, two distinguished-looking politicians, formally clad in the subdued version of the finery that courtiers had once deployed, austere grey and black tailoring over white silk, rather than the pre-revolutionary efflorescences of crimson and purple over explosions of lace. Like magpies surrounded by the crow-like figures of their attendants, they made their way toward the center of the web, ruled by the party secretary, Adrian Holmes. Holmes was indeed home this morning. They passed through an outer office in which clerks rattled the keys of no fewer than 6 computer terminals, wired no doubt to one of the municipal government mainframes that formed the beating heart of the Commonwealth cybernetic agaric allocator, the real-time central planning system that ran the state. Then they were ushered into the windowless inner office and the presence of the new man himself.
"Ah, the Commissioner's Burgesson."
Adrian Holmes hauled himself to his feet, beaming with a bonhomie Miriam suspected he cultivated only for high-ranking visitors. He could certainly switch it on and off like a light bulb. A tall man, dour of disposition, he was also a supremely effective administrator, which was why Adam had elevated him to the party secretariat at such a young age. He was barely 40.
"A bloody Robespierre," Olga had spat when she heard the news.
Miriam had pretended not to notice, but over time she'd come to suspect that her younger protégé might have been right when she'd said,
"You mark my words, my lady. Give him his head and he'll reap all of ours, even if he has to build his own guillotine."
Erasmus had not quite agreed.
"Not a Robespierre," he'd said gloomily, "but he might grow into Stalin's shoes. And what can I do for you today?"
"It's the boss," Erasmus said, affecting a slight nasality in his voice that elevated his tone but left it just short of a whine. It made him sound slightly stupid.
He'd developed the trick, Miriam had learned, while on the run before the revolution, as a way of convincing the political police he was harmless.
"Nobody told us.
We want to be added to the daily distribution list for Sir Adam's medical status," Miriam added. "Our commissions have definite need to know."
"I'm sure they do," Adrian agreed affably. "Propaganda and industrial espionage. Defending the indefensible, eh?"
He beamed, then continued.
"I'll see you're added to the list right away. Can't think why you weren't on it to begin with, honestly."
He sat down.
"Will you stay for a while? I'm not busy, and it's been too long since we've had a chance to chew the cud."
More likely he meant, "It's been too long since I had a chance to pick your brains." Adrian was often in the office for 18 hours a day, burning the midnight electricity. He had a mind like a man-trap, a superb memory, a grasp of the tiniest minutiae, and a pleasant demeanor. Miriam would have been entranced by him, and even considered him a possible suitable successor for the first man, if she hadn't also suspected him of being as ideologically flexible as a rubber band. A courtier's courtier, rather than a man of integrity.
"We really ought to get together sometime," Miriam smiled at him.
"Unfortunately, I've got to chair a meeting of the Joint Intelligence Committee this afternoon, and Erasmus has..." "What do you have, dear?"
"Contingency planning." Erasmus gave Holmes a fey smile. "Black crepe, martial music, state funeral with gun carriage and cathedral, and then what, eh?" "It's coming, Aide. Someone has to manage how we are seen in our hour of grief and all that."
"Don't rub it in too hard, you moron." Miriam wished, not for the first time, that marital vows conferred spousal telepathy. At times like this, it would have been more than handy. "What he means to say is that, strictly speaking, the dismal contingency facing us is going to dominate the news cycle for weeks, and he's already in the throes of planning for it."
Well, don't let me keep you.
Adrian grinned at her, or bared his teeth. It was much the same expression.
But we really must talk soon, you know, before we're overtaken by events.
You must come round for dinner sometime next week, Miriam offered. Have your people talk to my people. I'm sure we can sort out a quiet tete-a-tete. Just the three of us.
Absolutely, he said, his tone pleasant. I'll see when they can fit you in. My diary's filling up rather fast, I'm afraid. Ciao!
It was a dismissal. Not so long ago, a dismissal of that kind in that tone would have been the prerogative of the first man and none other. You simply did not dismiss two people's commissioners of cabinet rank. But thanks to a freakish piece of medical bad luck, time was running out for the first man, and it was anybody's guess who would pick up the reins when the driver left the carriage for the last time. Philadelphia, Timeline 2, Iron Gate, Timeline 3, August 2020. The lights along the railway platform switched on without warning. There were dozens, maybe even hundreds of them. Hot, pinkish-white tungsten filaments, sheathed in frosted white glass. Rita jumped down from the bench she'd been standing on and ran, shielding her glare-bruised eyes. Behind the station office, the side facing the brick wall was unlit, the shadows around it thick and deep. It's just this platform, she realized, as she flattened her back against the wall. She checked the time in her head-up display. 3:49. The rest of the switchyard was in darkness, but now she heard a rattle and a click, footsteps walking along the front of the building she'd taken shelter behind. Scheiße! The tracks! The tracks between her and the survey point for her jaunt home gleamed in reflected light. The switchyard floodlights were out, but up the line she saw signal lamps switch from red to blue. Night train coming. She licked her suddenly dry lips and took stock. I'm above ground level. The platform was about 5 feet above the track beds. She whispered, Maps, inertial, display current equivalent location. The head-up display delivered. She was about a third of a mile away from the colonel's big tent revival camp. If she jaunted home, she'd come out across a highway, maybe in someone else's parking lot. Maybe inside a shuttered Target. A sickening sense of relief turned her knees to jelly and threatened her with blackout. She'd risk a sprained ankle, but so what? The telemetry box could look after itself in a pinch. One-shot armband units cost only a few tens of thousands of dollars these days, according to Patrick. She took a deep breath. So let's stay and see what's going on. More footsteps. Then male voices, gruff and muffled by distance and corners. They were just at the edge of hearing, their accents strange.
Aye, Bill, that word right clever.
Inaudible reply.
Well, you can just get thyself across to thy signals and set the track block to ampass. Oh, and light up the yard. They're due in 10 minutes.
A rattle of keys in a lock. More footsteps. Then a heavy thud and a crunching of boots on ballast as someone, Bill, I'd guess, jumped down onto the tracks and headed away. The light changed, brightening slightly, possibly because Bill's interlocutor had entered the station office and turned on more lamps.
Video feed, last note, Rita whispered.
A grainy video window sprang to life in her head-up display, the interior of the station office. A middle-aged, overweight man with bushy sideboards and comic opera headgear. Is that a tricorn hat? Flopped down behind the computer terminal, punching laboriously at the keys with meaty index fingers. His coat or cloak or other outer garment, it was hard to tell. Ruffles and frogging obscured part of it. Hung over a hook on the back of the open door. Without looking, he reached sideways and picked up an antique telephone handset that trailed a pigtail coil of wire.
Station mate's office, he said.
his voice tinny but completely audible through the glass and the webcam pickup.
Eugene hailing.
A pause.
Yes, you should have a good signal in another minute.
He hung up. Rita felt rather than heard a faint rumble, followed by a hiss and shimmer of tracks rubbing against their tie-downs. She looked sideways and saw the light of a train, then heard a deep rumble and the crack of a spark as it approached, pantograph flaring momentarily against the overhead power cables. It was, she saw, a short passenger train. Like a commuter train, it had multiple doors spaced along each of its five carriages, but like a European high-speed express, it was streamlined and bullet-nosed. The windows were lit, showing an indistinct mass of people in dark coats sitting and standing within. Brakes sighed as it rolled alongside the platform and drifted to a standstill. Then the doors opened with a hiss to disgorge a torrent of bodies onto the front of the platform. Rita shuddered, wrung out on an adrenaline spike, and slid farther into the shadows. Doors rattled elsewhere in the station as the crowd stamped and shuffled their way toward an unseen exit. In her head-up display, she watched as the station master, station mate, she reminded herself, picked up his phone and pushed buttons on a blocky console below it.
Eugene hailing. The 4 o'clock shift change multiple is discharging onto platform 2 now. Prithee let the night shift in as soon as you sight the discharge, thanking you kindly.
There was more rumbling elsewhere in the switchyard. A long, slow freight train hove into view behind an oddly quiet locomotive. It hummed as it approached, a deep 60-cycle thrumming sound that carried even over the voices and echoing feet of the men from the passenger train. They were spreading out like an ant trail, leading into an open doorway just visible from one of Rita's other webcams. There have to be 300 of them, she realized. Maybe more. There'd been standing room only on the train. Men and women in coats or overalls, indistinctly glimpsed in the harsh station lights. She tried to get a look at them. Acquiring some idea of local fashions, Patrick had pointed out, was important in laying groundwork for future infiltration missions. But all she could really tell, without stepping out from her hiding place, was that most of them wore shapeless berets or caps and hats. She'd have to rely on the webcams for detail. The swarm of small-hour commuters didn't seem to be slackening, but now Rita noticed a new trend, people drifting back up the platform in ever-increasing numbers. They walked tiredly, stoop-shouldered as they climbed aboard the train. Going home, she noted. A 4 o'clock shift change. The train emptied out and refilled over a 5-minute period. Increasingly edgy, Rita fumbled with her super zoom, switching off the flash and diverting its output to her glasses. Then, taking her courage in both hands, she slowly eased the barrel lens around the corner of the building to record the last stragglers in more detail. Men and women in long woolen coats, cut almost like dusters. They wore dark clothes underneath, suits, or in some cases knee breeches and hose on the men. The women wore long skirts or Indian-style shalwar outfits, side-split tunics over loose trousers. Their faces were creased and rumpled by long, sleepless working hours. Factory workers, Rita speculated. Bethlehem's bones were built on iron and coal and the first steelworks. Was it any surprise there was heavy industry here, too? As the crowd thinned, she pulled back deeper into the shadows. An electric bell clanged harshly above the squeal and thud the freight train made as it crossed a sequence of points. Then the doors on the shift change train hissed shut, and with a buzzing whine it glided back the way it had come. Looking past the empty platform, Rita saw flatbed carriages rumbling and squealing past. Tarpaulins covered most of their loads, but there was something ominously familiar about the hunchbacked shapes beneath. A coy glimpse under a hem of oilcloth finally forced another dizzying perspective change upon her. She followed the edge of a track wrapped around a toothed drive wheel, the outline of hull, then turret and horizontal protrusion. Are those tanks? She wondered.
Hey! You! You missed your shift! Didn't you ken the hay?
Rita spun round. It was the station mate, waddling along the platform toward her, waving. Without thinking, she'd stepped forward toward the freight train, and now he'd seen her. Abort, 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 she said aloud, trying to ignore her stomach churn. Raised her left forearm, squeezed for the return trigger.
Hey, you, let's see your pass.
She jaunted in a panicky moment, falling hard onto soft grass and going over on her left hip. Falling hurt, but she pushed herself upright immediately and jaunted again, this time into an empty parking lot, on the other side of the highway from her starting point. I blew it, she realized dismally. I totally suck at spying. And then the true implications of what she'd witnessed struck her like lightning. Tanks. High-speed commuter trains. Computers. My God, what have we stumbled across? Baltimore. Timeline 2. August 2020. Federal employee 00493031 classified voice transcript. Dr. Scranton. The way I read this action summary, we're burned. She's not going to be able to go back there again. Colonel, anything to add? Colonel Smith. We learned a lot, and I'm not sure it went as badly as you think. Liaison, State Department. Yes, but our jaunt blue asset was exposed. She could have been killed. As it was, she barely escaped by the skin of her... Colonel Smith. Nonsense. Don't over-dramatize. Liaison, State Department. But she could have been shot. Dr. Scranton, wearily. Gentlemen. As you were saying, Colonel. Colonel Smith. Rita aborted the mission early, but completely in line with her instructions. Do not risk confrontation. Avoid exposure. The telemetry capsule auto-returned on schedule, as expected. The mission was truncated, but we made a full recovery and we learned a lot. Let me go over the pluses and minuses, Dr. Scranton. Please do. Colonel Smith. First, the pluses. She retrieved the logs from the Mission 1 nomadic surveillance nodes. She released the Mission 2 micro UAV spybirds. She planted 6 webcams on 2 different manned installations. We got an invaluable look at the inside of a railroad office and at some rolling stock. Our analysts are still drooling over the take because it's gold dust. And she got a look up close with a telephoto lens at a whole bunch of railroad employees and factory workers. Dr. Scranton, analysis later. Colonel Smith, okay. The minuses. We weren't expecting the station to be busy at 4 in the morning, and Rita was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. The station master, the station office video stream shows that he wasn't armed, so she wasn't in immediate danger. Nevertheless, she jaunted out of there. So we're left with a witness, singular, to a jaunt blue departure at dead of night. Which means that unless they're aware of world walkers, they'll probably write it off as a hallucination or a funny spell or something. So while I don't think it's advisable to send Rita back to the switchyard, I don't think she's blown. In fact, I'd recommend bringing Phase 2 forward. Liaison, State Department. What do the analysts say? What did we get out of this? Colonel Smith. Lots. They've got computer terminals in offices. Old-style cathode ray tube monitors with odd keyboards, but it's the real thing. And they use electric traction for railroads. That commuter train Rita witnessed is a big tell. It's an electric multiple unit with Jacob's bogies, Dr. Scranton. What are those? Colonel Smith. It's a special wheel layout. French and Chinese high-speed trains use them. Saves weight, but means the cars can't be uncoupled. It's common on passenger trains that run upward of 150 miles per hour. Not ours, in other words.
Dr. Scranton. So it's fast?
Colonel Smith. They have a fully electrified wide-gauge railway network and use high-speed commuter trains to move people to and from industrial plants. Those low-altitude records we got from the Nats? Lots of 12-story buildings, surrounded by foliage. The lack of suburban sprawl and highways is all consistent with a planned social housing infrastructure, built around apartment blocks and lots of urban light rail.
Liaison, State Department.
You mean they live in apartments and commute by streetcar and train?
Dr. Scranton.
Yes. This tells us something about their financial system and economy, by the way. They're a rent-not-buy country, so their consumer economy probably isn't debt-backed and underwritten by an asset bubble. I mean, we might be looking at condominiums, but then we'd expect to see some McMansions as well, and suburban sprawl around highways. And we're just not seeing that. So either they're old-school commies who live in state-run apartments, or they're like Germany or Japan, hard-working savers who don't mortgage up and whose real estate depreciates after it's built. Possibly they've got state land ownership.
Liaison, State Department.
That sounds pretty un-American.
Colonel Smith.
Yes. And then there was the flatbed Rita spotted. I brought a print for you.
Liaison, State Department.
Jesus, that's a tank. Jesus.
Colonel Smith.
A shift change at 0400 hours suggests to me that they're working round the clock 24/7. The webcams got us an estimated headcount of 480 workers, plus or minus 20. Now, they might have multiple staggered shifts, but even if they're swapping out 500 workers every hour, that maxes out at 4,000 to 6,000 in whatever factory they're at. And that train, well, our best estimate is that it was carrying about 60 main battle tanks, M1 Abrams class or similar, judging by what was visible of their hull box size, suspension layout, and turret design. Enough to equip the core of a mechanized infantry brigade.
Dr. Scranton.
Are they highly automated?
Colonel Smith.
We might be wrong. The munitions train might have been a coincidence, but rolling out of the vicinity of Bethlehem, Appalachian coal and iron country? If you're going to start building heavy metal in North America, that's one of the places you'd begin. If they're producing tanks there and the factory only employs a few thousand people, then that implies highly efficient manufacturing. I mean, there might be other satellite stations serving the other side of a big complex. Or maybe they run a reduced maintenance shift at night, and these were the cleaners and janitors going home, but I'm calling this a clear indicator of 1960s technology or later, just not our 1960s. We might be wrong about the housing and finance stuff, by the way. It might just be a local dorms for factory workers kind of thing. We won't know until we get boots on the ground and noses in library books. But it looks like kind of a Soviet setup to me. Paranoid and heavily armed with nuclear weapons.
Dr. Scranton.
Okay, Colonel. Now here's a leading question. If this was your show, where would you want to take it? Feel free to brainstorm. I'm open to ideas.
Colonel Smith.
Well, I don't think we're going to learn much more that's useful by having Rita stumble around a switchyard at night. For one thing, it's dangerous, and for another, we got what we came for. What we need now is cultural intelligence. All the little details our future agents will need to operate in place. We also need large-scale SIGINT and ELINT snooping programs, but that's a job for the National Reconnaissance Office. I imagine they've got armband-equipped spy sats with capsule return systems like the old Keyhole series, or some equivalent. But we probably want to hold off on lobbing heavy metals into orbit until we know if these people have satellites of their own. We don't want to set off World War III by accident. It's going to happen sooner or later if we plan to engage with them, but not yet. In the meantime, I'd strongly recommend pushing Phase 2, maybe into Philly proper.
The social housing thing raises an added risk factor. Fewer safe houses where agents won't be under scrutiny from the neighbors. But we've got enough videoed that our wardrobe departments say they can knock off a costume that will stand up at a distance. And thanks to the webcams, we should have enough dialogue for linguistics to start working up a training kit in a week or so. And we can iterate. It gets riskier from here on in, but Rita's resourceful. As long as we give her as much support as she wants and as much elbow room as she needs, she'll do fine.
Dr. Scranton.
Right. So tell me how we're going to do it.
End transcript.